From APR, American Public Radio.
Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A. It's now widely thought that the watershed events that culminated in the dramatic collapse of communism caught the West and its policymakers completely by surprise. But this view seriously underestimates the strategy designed and conducted by American foreign policymakers in response to changing conditions in Eastern Europe and the challenge of Gorbachev's new thinking. My guest is Ambassador Robert Hutchings, former Director for European Affairs with the National Security Council. Bob Hutchings, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you very much, George.
Bob, this is a subject that not only is of extraordinary importance, but it's one we're all living and witnessing, and I guess most of us have been paying a great deal of attention to it over the past few years. And it's also, I think, a tale largely of what was foreseen and what was done about it. And this is, of course, the subject of your own scholarship and writing now. And when we talk about things that were foreseen, I think we're also talking about a sense of history, of people being able to put things in context. And with that as an introduction, I'd like to ask you for the origins of our story by looking backwards, in a sense, at three cardinal events that influenced strongly policy and our policy toward Eastern Europe and Russia. I'm referring here, Bob, to the Hungarian Revolt of 1956, the Prague Spring in Czechoslovakia in 1968, and Poland's defiance, Lech Walesa, we all remember being so extraordinary in 1981. What sort of interpretation did you and the NSC make of these events?
Well, I think you did choose the three cardinal events in the history of East Central Europe since the war, since the imposition of communist rule. 1956, I think, was the first blow against communist ideology in the region. I think before that, in the immediate aftermath of World War II, there was some support. There was some electoral support, genuine electoral support, for the communist parties in power. Little did the voters know what they were voting for, but there was some residual support. With 56 and the forcible repression of a peaceful, democratic revolution, I think this was the first major blow to the ideology. 1968, the Prague Spring, the Warsaw Pact, the Soviet-led Warsaw Pact invasion of Czechoslovakia in August of that year was the major blow to reform communism. The idea that the system that had been inherited from Stalin and his allies in Eastern Europe could be reformed, made more humane, more tolerable, could change in fundamental ways. I think this was destroyed, largely destroyed, with 1968.
Uh-huh.
That brings us up to 1980-81 and the rise of Solidarity, which I remember, the rise and then suppression of Solidarity, which I remember very well because I was deputy director of Radio Free Europe during that entire period. And here, if any further proof was needed, was the demonstration. This was a self-organized workers' revolt against a self-proclaimed workers' state. And the manifestos that were issued by Solidarity, Lech Walesa, and his intellectual advisors made it clear that they felt any form of communist ideology to be basically irrelevant to Poland's needs.
So that this any attempt at reforming communism, so to speak, was absolutely discredited.
That's right.
At that point.
That's right.
And you make a very good point. I think many either have overlooked or perhaps forgotten that when you distinguish between elite and popular attitudes, and then cite the Polish example, that much of what we've seen and witnessed has really been a groundswell, has it not, Bob? Kind of a popular rejection of communism.
It has indeed. And I think American policy, together with the British, but better than continental European policy, made this distinction more clearly. Mm-hmm. We obviously had certain dealings with the communist regimes, but we never allowed that to mean cutting off a dialogue, an active dialogue, or as active a dialogue as was possible with the democratic opposition and independent forces in those societies. It was always a dual policy.
Interesting.
And we never believed that the communist regimes in Eastern Europe represented stability, represented those with whom we could deal constructively.
I'd like to bring into our discussion two more events, if you will, Bob, and sort of get your assessment of them and how they led thinkers on the NSC to think about the major policy questions being raised. For many, they're the proximate events, if you will, of the Eastern European crisis of recent years. I'm referring here to Mikhail Gorbachev's announcement of new thinking in 1988 And Poland's election is a few months later, which the roundtable agreement to have an election, focusing on the new thinking, the Gorbachev statement of new thinking. I guess the most basic question to ask you is precisely what was it and what was it intended to do? I mean, why did he have to make a statement about new thinking?
New thinking is one of the more slippery ideas around. It was really a concept in evolution because the term had been used very early on in Gorbachev's tenure in Moscow, dating from 1985. And really, if you look at the first 5 years, first 4 years of Gorbachev's tenure, it was a mixed picture. The initial years were not dissimilar from Yuri Andropov, of trying to tinker with the system, a war on alcoholism and corruption, trying to make the administration more efficient and effective, but not really a reformist agenda. Then it moved into a phase of somewhat more radical reform, but still stopping well short of challenging the basic primacy of the Communist Party, the command economy, and all the rest. And it was only as those half-measures failed to have the desired effect that more radical measures began to be undertaken.
When he does begin to advocate policies, Bob, that we could identify as, in quotes again, new thinking in this context, what precisely were they in essence, and what was he trying to achieve by them?
The new thinking, I think the goals of Soviet new thinking were fairly well understood, and I'm not saying that those of us on the NSC staff had a unique window on the truth here. This is fairly well understood both here and in Europe, inside governments and out, that the Soviet economy was in a state of severe deterioration, that Soviet military spending was contributing to that, that the Soviet foreign policy misadventures of the Brezhnev era and after had cost the Soviet Union dearly, and that there needed to be a period of internal regeneration, perestroika and glasnost inside the Soviet Union, and a respite from international conflict outside. And that was where Gorbachev was looking, both for more cooperative relations with the major Western countries, including cooperative economic relations, and looking for a way of building down the costly arms buildup.
This is interesting, Bob, very interesting. The point at which you mentioned the Gorbachev seeking, and here I like your phrase very much, a respite from international conflict. I'm trying to get a sense of how the NSC was interpreting this new thinking from our vantage point. And was that the breach, in a sense, sort of opened to use a term in vogue, window of opportunity for our thinking about it, particularly in terms of Eastern Europe? I mean, just to carry on a bit further, it seems to me that kind of approach suggests a rejection of the Brezhnev doctrine, or at least the possibility of rejecting the Brezhnev doctrine of intervention in Eastern Europe.
I would put it just as you put it. It suggested the possibility of the end of the Brezhnev doctrine.
Right.
Our view, our general view, and there were pessimists and there were optimists, and one could identify one group or another in the administration or in Europe or outside government altogether. But I think the general view was that new thinking had yet to be filled up with substantive content. It had potential, and that potential could be influenced by Western, especially American, behavior. And that was the goal, was that how could we take what was implicit or suggested in the policy of new thinking, sometimes even in the letter of what Gorbachev had said or written, and turn it into a reality that had tangible benefits, not just a rhetorical benefit in an improved atmosphere in East-West relations.
This now gets very fascinating, Bob. I get a sense from you, and I hope this does not disturb the seriousness of our topic, that what we are given in the new thinking at that time is kind of a bold headline, and from the NSC's point of view, it's an opportunity for us to help write the article that follows that headline to kind of influence the fleshing out, if you will, of what that means. And if I'm correct in that kind of somewhat superficial overview, what precisely did we decide to do? What would be the linchpin, from our point of view, of making that happen?
There were several, and I think you've characterized it right, that the strategy was one of testing in a practical way, not in the sense of giving a final examination, but testing Soviet new thinking through U.S. and other Western initiatives to see if the Soviet Union would respond in kind to begin addressing some of the fundamental issues, not just the atmospheric issues. What were these fundamental issues? Well, they began in Europe. They weren't limited to Europe. They began with the presence in the middle of Europe of nearly 600,000 Soviet troops, which we had never considered a legitimate defense force. It was there for no legitimate reason in our view. The occupation of several of the countries of Central Europe and the imposition of an empire in this region under Moscow's control. So Eastern Europe was at the center from the very beginning. And I should point out that Eastern Europe meant not just the freedom and independence of the peoples of this region, although that was certainly an important part of it. It also meant the occupation, the forward deployment of so many Soviet forces. It also meant a Soviet Union that seemed to require a ring of buffer states, of client states around its key borders in order to pursue its international interests. And we felt that that's why the key issues came to a head in Central and Eastern Europe. If those could be addressed, if those fundamental issues could be addressed, then all the other issues that were implicit in Soviet policy, the strategic balance, Afghanistan, support for revolutionary movements in Central America, these had a better chance of being resolved.
Mm-hmm. This, I'll use the word again, it is really fascinating to me, Bob. I see, and tell me if I'm wrong in this, two things being simultaneously advanced through this. One, of course, is, as you very clearly point out, to make Eastern Europe the testing ground of sincerity, in a sense, and to establish that region as being the crucible of seriousness on the part of Gorbachev and the Soviet Union. But in additionally, I have a sense, and here tell me if I've gone too far, that it's also saying what we're really after here is the end of the Cold War.
That's precisely it. I mean, there was a sense that there was, at the end of 1988 and the beginning of 1989, and here comes the event in Poland that you mentioned, the Roundtable Agreement, this carried with it the potential for ending the Cold War. Mm. And that was the assumption behind the strategy we tried to develop to carry us through this period and bring about what only a few years earlier would have seemed impossibly distant, that is the end of Europe's division and the end of the Cold War.
Bob, I think you might help us all by giving us a sense of why you thought that the Poland Roundtable Agreement of 1989 was that significant.
This, together with Soviet statements, including a statement by Gorbachev at the UN in late 1988, December 1988, in which he announced the unilateral withdrawal of a significant number of Soviet troops from Central and Eastern Europe. This, in our view, was more than a gesture. This was something tangible. Then came the Polish Roundtable Agreement of March-April 1989, in which the Church, with the Church's oversight, Solidarity, and the communist regime of General Jaruzelski agreed to hold free and fair parliamentary elections the coming summer, the summer of 1989. There were certain provisos, certain guaranteed seats for the ruling Communist Party and several others, but still, what they forecast was free and fair parliamentary elections. Our assumption, our belief then, was that if the Roundtable Agreement was fully and faithfully implemented, and free and fair elections were in fact held, that this was the beginning of the end of communist rule in Poland. And if communist rule was coming to an end in Poland, it was coming to an end everywhere in Central and Eastern Europe. And that meant also in East Germany. Therefore, German unification had just come onto the international agenda. Now, this may sound too clever by hindsight, and so I should qualify this in saying we certainly didn't foresee these events taking place in a matter of months.
Yeah.
We saw a multi-year process, as did Solidarity strategists around Lech Wałęsa. They hoped that Solidarity could make a good showing in the June elections, perhaps share power, and then 3 years later in the next parliamentary elections actually win, so that over a course of 3 to 5 to 6 years, they might actually take power, and communist rule would be coming to an end. So in seeing the potential of this process, we thought we were devising a strategy for probably the end of the century. Not just for the next 3 months.
Well, I think the speed certainly, I think, a surprise astounded everyone. But you know, even if it had taken the time that you were thinking of, it was still a remarkable act of prescience to see this kind of outcome from the events of that period. Bob, there's a lot more to talk to you about, and I must say that I'm enjoying all of this famously. Let me take a moment though from our conversation and just remind everyone that the program is Dialogue. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Robert Hutchings, former Director for European Political Affairs with the National Security Council. Bob Hutchings has also served as Deputy Director of Radio Free Europe, taught at Johns Hopkins and the University of Virginia, and served as a United States Naval Officer. Currently a fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center, Ambassador Hutchings graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy, completed a master's degree at William & Mary, and received his Ph.D. from the University of Virginia. You know what, it seems to me, Bob, we could, rhetorically but meaningfully, I think, cast a lot of our discussion, the themes, if you will, of what we were trying to achieve and what Mr. Gorbachev was initially trying to achieve in context by using two phrases that became very, very much heard in the world in that time. And I'm thinking here of Gorbachev's advancement, promotion of what he called a common European home. and President Bush, and here we do begin to get into what was said in the speeches, his conception of Europe whole and free. And I think that these are two, there's much more than just a rhetorical conflict of ideas here, isn't there?
There was something very fundamental there, and I was pleased to read a recent very good book by Tim Garton Ash, the British historian and journalist, who caught this juxtaposition, which really came to a head in May, June, July of 1989, because that's when the two concepts were being publicly presented. The common European home, among its other difficulties, posited the permanence of what Gorbachev called two social systems in Europe. That is, we in the West had to accept the permanence of their social system. The two were equivalent. They had a right to have theirs, we had a right to have ours, and both sides should recognize that. And only on that basis could we then begin to build East-West relations on a new footing. This, of course, ignored the aspirations of virtually the entire populations of Central and Eastern Europe, and certainly ignored what was actively going on in Poland and Hungary under the through the democratic oppositions there. And it's also interesting, are there only two social systems in Europe? Or are there many social systems? There's Swedish social democracy, there's Swiss confederalism. There are a lot of different social systems, some in the West, some in the East. Why just two? And why should we in the West accept as a premise of international relations the permanence of these, quote, political realities? Europe whole and free was the term, I never much liked the term, frankly, but I liked very much what it embodied.
Right.
It was a very simple concept, and that was the rights of self-determination, the rights to liberty, political and economic, the rights to independence, state independence, and freedom from imposition of alien rule on countries who had been suffering under this rule for two generations.
This is, I think, a very helpful reminder that political rhetoric is not just, I mean, it's often ridiculed, and we both know that in the popular press and elsewhere, but there's real meaning to phrases. I mean, these are crafted with some intention in mind. And it strikes me, Bob, that if we had accepted a common European home, that's really the status quo, with maybe a slight plus, but basically the status quo, is it not?
A more humane, more civilized, less risky status quo, but with a lot of fundamental problems still remaining.
So when President Bush, on the other hand, was speaking of Europe whole and free, that is really, that is our notion of precisely that, a Europe that is not being imposed upon by
outside forces. That's right, in which liberty and independence are made possible, self-determination is made possible, and the conditions are created for overcoming, ending the division of Europe and the East-West division. I might just, if I could just add one point that I just came across in the course of my own research, speaking of words. April 17th, 1989, President Bush gave a speech in which he quoted Victor Hugo, that there's nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come. And Bush then said, my friends, that idea is liberty. 10 days later, in Bonn, German Foreign Minister Genscher gave a speech in which he also quoted Victor Hugo, without acknowledging the source. Nothing more powerful than an idea has come. My friends, that idea is demilitarization. Well, there you have it.
Yeah.
Freedom or demilitarization?
Right. You know, when you mentioned Prime Minister Genscher, you remind me that a big part of what was being attempted now depended upon our ability to coordinate things, both internally in terms of the executive branch here at home, but also with our allies abroad. And these were two very, very difficult things to do. In fact, I know from your scholarship that you have stated there are four prerequisites for kind of getting this policy across the American people and then sort of across to the Russians as well. Briefly stated, making it bipartisan, which is always very important for us in America in terms of any foreign policy, making the executive branch cohere, and then this third point of allied unity. And I'd love to hear you speak to that, Bob, because it seems to me that this whole episode, this whole era, really brought to the fore some developing differences between us and Great Britain, and us and France, and Great Britain and France and Germany. Players were assuming different roles.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that the alliance was in crisis in early 1989. There's periodic reports that the alliance is in crisis. We've heard those from the entire history of the North Atlantic Alliance. But there were some divergences. There was, first of all, a renewed European move toward economic and then political union, which meant a more assertive Europe. Europe, in this case, meaning the Europe of the 12 in the European community, not yet all of Europe. Also in the foreign policy and security fields, which created certain strains. There was a nuclear debate fueled by perceptions among many in Europe that the United States was too slow to respond to Soviet peace initiatives almost all of them in the nuclear field, not in the conventional force field. Misgivings about American leadership. We'd gone from evil empire to Star Wars to, as some may recall, the Reykjavik summit in which President Reagan and then Chairman Gorbachev seemed to have agreed to the complete denuclearization of their two arsenals, thereby undercutting the entire post-war history of nuclear deterrence. So it was a period of some confusion, and Europeans were waiting to look for a sign of American constancy and American leadership, or at least American co-leadership.
Mm-hmm. But in looking for that, they all had their own conceptions of what that should be, did they not? I mean, one of the things that I think that I found most intriguing was Margaret Thatcher, of course, then Prime Minister of Great Britain, must have been concerned about the degree to which any overture of this kind on our part in light of changed conditions in Europe would bring us closer, for example, to Germans and to Germany, rather, and perhaps weaken the special relationship with Great Britain as we were seeking these goals.
I think so. Despite the fact that Mrs. Thatcher found Gorbachev, quote, a man I can do business with, unquote, the British generally were the most skeptical of Soviet intentions, Soviet motives. They worried that clever Soviet peace schemes would divide the West, would lure Western countries, especially the West Germans, in their view, down the garden path of the common European home. Mm-hmm. The French were seized with the urgent need to realize the vision of a more unified federal Europe under Franco-German leadership. And the more change took place in the East, the more urgent the task in French eyes of cementing the process in the West.
Right.
And there were the Germans, who, for reasons of geography as well as long-standing political convictions, were the most eager to respond to Soviet initiatives. And I don't think I'm being unfair here. Let's say that the German conception was one of stabilizing and reassuring Eastern governments in order to permit a very gradual, very slow, almost imperceptible relaxation internally.
Mm-hmm.
But that the key interlocutors were the governments, especially reform-minded governments in the East.
Did the Germans, because this was one of the most dramatic consequences of all that transpired, did they at that point, Bob, in your understanding, have the sense that all of this could lead to reunification?
I think that notion began to take hold in the late summer of 1989 and early fall, and certainly accelerated after the breach of the Berlin Wall in November 9th. But there's a danger that some German politicians may now remember, with the benefit of hindsight, that they saw it all coming much earlier.
Yeah.
I suppose there's a danger for American policymakers of doing the same thing. I recall being at a conference in Berlin October 1st to 3rd, 1989, dealing with Germany, in which East and West Germans were present, Americans, British, French, policymakers and scholars alike, and this was already well into those events. We already, at that point, had a non-communist prime minister in Poland. Hungary had already dismantled the Iron Curtain between Hungary and Austria. East German refugees had already come out in large numbers through Hungary and later Czechoslovakia, so things were already well moving, but nobody at that conference was talking about German unification as a prospect for the immediate future. It was more a scenario for the next 5 to 10 years, and even then, no one would dare call that a prediction, but just a scenario.
A scenario. Bob, to conclude our conversation, I'd like to sort of stay on this theme of German reunification and use a very recent and I thought quite striking event to symbolize it. Helmut Kohl was recently here in Washington, and as a part of his visit, he awarded the Grand Cross of the Order of Merit, Germany's highest award, as I understand it, to former President George Bush and former Secretary of State Jim Baker. I sort of thought of that as a kind of a symbolic verification of the points that you've been making in this conversation. But I'm wondering, first of all, against the outcome that we all know and this kind of a symbolic gesture on the part of the Germans, what would you say might be the political verdict on this in terms of political costs, transatlantic political costs, or other things that we might not immediately have perceived in the wake of all this euphoria and awarding of medals and so forth?
Well, first of all, I think the awarding of the Order of Merit to President Bush and Secretary Baker was well-deserved. Their leadership was important, and I would say in some ways decisive for the successful outcome of German unification. but the public spoke in the fall of 92, and I think the fact that President Bush lost that election, the fact that Chancellor Kohl is in tremendous electoral difficulty at home, demonstrates how much the world has changed, how much we've moved into a new era with public expectations for delivery of a post-Cold War agenda, many items of which were seen by publics as being deferred during long years of Cold War. Now they've come to the fore, and public expectations are very high. And I think on both sides of the Atlantic, governments in power and major political parties out of power are going through a period of disorientation in trying to find their way, trying to articulate how their country should find their way in this new world.
Mm. Well, that, Bob, I think that, like this entire conversation, is very perceptive, and you make, I think, all of us aware of the fact that there's going to be a lot of shaking down in the new politics that follows the new thinking and the new reality as time goes on.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today on Dialogue.
My pleasure.
You have been listening to Dialogue, and my guest today was Robert Hutchings, former director for European Affairs with the National Security Council. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier. Our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by APR, American Public Radio, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For a cassette copy of this program, or for more information, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444. From APR, American Public Radio.